Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, you know what? If you like this podcast that I appreciate you've not listened to yet, because this is right at the start, but if you listen to this and find out you do like it, then afterwards, go onto the computer or phone and search for the Lush podcast. It's the podcast where Lush, unsurprisingly, the Lush podcast, talk about the things that we think you'd be interested in hearing. So check it out. It's called the Lush podcast. And the easy way to remember that, how I remember it, is it's a podcast made by Lush. Cool. Have a listen. I might even host one time. You never know. Probably not after this audition. Done.
Welcome to Tiny Revolutions with me, Tiff Stevenson, the podcast that asks if comedy can be a force for social change. Please welcome to Tiny Revolutions, Kiri Pritchard-McLean. Yes. Isn't it nice to be clapped on?
Yeah, and without the introduction of this next comedian is lovely, which is their way of going, she's not really funny. So I quite like just like pure like happiness is quite nice.
The lovely. I suppose it's changed now from being the next comic is a woman.
Yeah, that's true.
So they feel like they have to put a description. Maybe it's a way of leading the audience into thinking, I've got to tell them. I've got to tell them there's ovaries happening. Well, I describe the next act. Let's go lovely, because no one ever says that about men. Have you ever heard a man described as lovely?
Not beyond being a child. No, you hear from like
a lovely little boy.
Yeah, exactly. But never an adult man.
Look at this gorgeous, lovely boy. Who did? I heard Phyllis Diller describe someone as darling recently, and I was like, oh, that's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Darling, you should always be darling. So welcome to the podcast. And what we explore on this podcast is whether or not comedy can be a force for social change. And we've been very specific about who we asked to come on, because I am talking to a range of people, but all people that I believe have done something in their stand-up or on stage which contributes to a part of a bigger discussion or societal change and moving forward. And I could say, not almost every, but a lot of the female comedians, I believe, are part of a social change by talking about stuff that has been previously considered taboo or previously considered to be... I wasn't going to say taboo as in periods, because we've talked about that before. But I know, for example, your latest show, the one you did at the Fringe this year, is called Victim Complex, is
yeah,
it?
Like, yeah,
Victim, Complex. So it's important that I get that right. So, and in that, do you talk about an abusive relationship?
Yeah, I talk. It's about gaslighting, basically. Spoiler alert if you come and see it. But yeah, that was about, I mean, I was writing a show on something else. I was writing a show on empathy, and I had been talking to non-offending paedophiles. Had to put them on ice. So I was writing that, and then all this stuff was happening in my personal life, and I just couldn't, like, not take it on stage as a way of, like, it sounds so wanky, but processing it. And then the more I started talking about it, the weird first a kind of backlash was people being like, oh, well, that wouldn't happen to you because I'm kind of like an empowered, smart woman. And me as well, while it was happening, being like, oh, this isn't, I know how this feels and I know what's happening to me, but it's not what I think is happening isn't, because I wouldn't let something like that happen to me. You know, you just think that because you're, you know, all these things that you pride yourself in being, you can't possibly be the victim of an abusive relationship. So yeah, I just thought, but then what happens is you just think you're going insane and it's terrifying. And then I started talking about it. And like, as I was talking about it, the behavior, we weren't together anymore, but it escalated. So the she's insane, she's a liar, she's mad, like just really blew up and was on kind of social media. And like more and more of my friends like were being sort of taken aside to be told, yeah, not taken aside, but you know, like that was the conversation around me, was that I was a very sick liar. And it was like, you believe it as well because you've been told it for years. And then like the truth comes out and like everything you thought was happening and you weren't losing your mind. But by that time you've gone mental anyway. So yeah, I started talking about it and I just wanted this show to kind of reclaim the narrative. That wasn't even like, I'm going to set the record straight. I was like, I have to talk about this. And as soon as I started doing very early previews of it, my memory was a room full of nodding women. So me talking about, and you say this thing and they say that thing to you, and just women being like, yeah, absolutely. And just the response of people coming up after shows or messaging. I've had about like 500 messages from people who are like, you just told my story almost beat for beat, the exact same phrases, the exact same behavior. I thought I was insane. My friends thought I was mad, because that's what happened to me. We're in the same friendship circle and my closest friends thought I just lost my mind. And then when it came out, they were like, oh God.
Now, what's interesting is for some listeners that may not know, and I think most people that are switched on to this podcast and listening to it will probably be up to date with what gaslighting is. But it was a term originally coined, I think it's a 1950s American film.
So it comes from a play that was written in 1938 by Patrick Hamilton. Then it was made into, there's two films.
Right. And it's about a woman who is manipulated by her partner. And I think the term gaslighting comes from the fact that he's switching lights on and off.
So he's searching the house for these jewels to sell them behind her back. And as he's moving upstairs, the gas lights flicker. And she's like, someone's upstairs when he comes home, in inverted commas.
Right.
And she's like, I can see the lights flickering. He's like, no, it's all in your head. And because she loves him, she believes him.
So that's the literal translation of what gaslighting is.
Yeah.
But it's manipulating reality or things that are happening to make a person believe that they're crazy or doubt their own memory or ideas of what's happened.
Yeah.
And I think the reason that that's landed and connected so much is, like you say, so many women have been through that to a degree, especially with any kind of breakup or in a relationship that's coming to an end. The lack of willingness. I mean, certainly when I've been with someone for 11 years now, so I am kind of, it's not that it's a distant memory for me. It definitely happened to me. It definitely happened to me loads. The craziness of kind of going, she tried to take my phone to look to see if they were like, or she showed up, or she said to this girl that she was suspicious that we were sleeping together and we definitely weren't. From that small thing to being like, we kind of were.
Yeah.
And I posted about her, or I did a private thing, or but definitely being manipulated or being told a version of what you said is something that's happened to me. And it's not just within relationships. It can happen within meetings or
totally
within what we do for work. You can be in a room as a woman and make a suggestion, and 5 minutes later, a guy makes that same suggestion and they're like, that's such a great idea. And you're like, is everyone mad?
Yeah.
I literally just said that to you.
Yeah.
Like I have, you know, that how often that happens. But what kind of examples of that behaviour would you?
Well, I'm fascinated by the fact that it is like endemic. It's not just like romantic relationships. There's been people who messaged me who had it with their family. Their parents used to do it to them. Would, you know, and that, how scary is that? They're your anchor.
Yeah.
And they're the people who are making you think that you don't know your own mind. And work is such a common one where someone, or like I talk about an example in the show where someone goes, oh, have you done that work for me? And you go, no. And they go, I asked you to do it. In your head, you're like, I know you didn't, because I've been sat here so bored. I would love to have done some work. I've been trying to pretend to work. But you just go, okay, I must have forgotten. But there's so many times where you just are constantly taught to, like, especially as women, to doubt your
yourself.
Own mind. Yeah,
doubt
exactly.
Yourself.
And also the fact that, like, that all the language around kind of neuroses and hysteria and psychosis is so gendered. So like the fact that, like, we're
hysteria,
not
hysterical from the Greek for womb.
Yeah, exactly.
As in our wombs make us go crazy. I found this one out the other day, which I just thought was incredible. Vagina is actually from the Latin for sword sheath. So that is a physical part of us. No wonder men feel like it's their God-given right to be inside you. Like, I can't think of a more perfect example of, well, that's
where I keep my willy.
That's where I keep my penis. Like, so the language of all of that, because women weren't considered, that's why so little is known about women's diseases.
Yeah.
And in medical terms of, like, testing and finding out about diseases, it was all men or things that affected men.
Yeah.
But something as small as that, and I use that word all the time, and now I'm going to be like, I don't want to use that word anymore.
Yeah,
I don't
want
to use
word.
A Latin word for a man's place to store his knob. I'm not having that. I'm not having that as my biological reality. Sorry. That's not what that's for. So, yeah. So like you say, those words like hysteria.
It just feels really gendered.
Crazy ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, even that as a phrase. And also that stuff that, like, how dare we be brought up? Like, we've all had this where, like, you hear boys around you being like, oh, she's mental, she's crazy, that kind of thing. And, like, we've been that girl where they treat you like a girlfriend, then they go cold on you, then they're really intense again, and they're like, sorry, I'm not great at opening up, and they text you all the time, and then they go quiet on you. And
that's breadcrumbing, isn't it?
Is that breadcrumbing?
Yeah, see, there's so many terms for this. Breadcrumbing is where you give a little bit to someone, and they go, oh, they're still interested, and then you withdraw again. And then you, so it's like a breadcrumb. So you might get a text, and then you might meet and have, like, a bit of a, like, you know, it could be friends with benefits type thing. But breadcrumbing is where they leave a little pile and leave a little pile and leave a little pile. Just enough. If you're starving, a breadcrumb is amazing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're starving for that affection or attention of that other person. You're like, oh, it's this little drop of hope in an ocean of despair. So,
but it's that whole thing that we're taught that, like, and when they go, oh, it's because you're being crazy, you're like, oh, I guess so, because that is a narrative that makes sense to you, because it's always portrayals of women being sort of intense and neurotic and
emotional.
Yeah, and overly emotional, as opposed to, like, dudes just being pricks sometimes.
Well, and also, and I think the other side of that is men not being able to talk about their feelings. And I'm not a fan of the phrase toxic masculinity, I should say, because I think it makes men sound biohazardous. But I understand the basis of it being that men shouldn't be emotional or talk about their feelings. So there's this sense of bravado and testosterone that always sort of comes to the front, which is part of this whole conversation around consent. You know, if girls own their sexual agents, if girls have sexual agency and they own their desires and know that it's okay to express those, and men know it's okay to express emotions or boys, you know, then we'd be in a much better place.
Definitely.
As a society. But that is part of it. It's like women, they're too emotional. Oh, you're bringing emotion into it. And you go, no, you know, men can have emotions as well.
Yeah.
But around them, their peer group and what people tell them is that, no, you shouldn't have that. And also, you're a don. That's what I thought about the vagina, the sheath thing. I thought conquering, the idea of, like, a conquest.
Yeah.
You know, that women are something to be achieved and attained. And then once you've got that piece of land or that thing, then you move on. But how do you separate yourself from that? Make it that they're crazy. It's not your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
It's their fault for being emotional. And
yeah. And exactly. It all comes back to our problem. And because also, like, even again, as, like, an educated, empowered woman, to be told, like, you've been, like, one of those girls, I'm like, oh, well, I've always prided myself on not being one of those girls. You know, like, you don't want to be that insane, because we do know people, not just women, but the ones we can remember, all women, that are fucking bonkers. So, like, when they're going, you're behaving like that, you're like, no, I'm not, because I'm not one of those people.
Or it's the trigger is if your partner says to you, you're acting like your mum. Do you ever get that one? That's my one. That's something your mum would do. And I'm like, you never do that to me. And you know to not do that to me. But it's a real, like, that's like pushing a button. That's like your Achilles heel, you know.
I get it with, like, my partner now, he's great. But, like, you know, when they're like, are you on your period? And that, like, my ex used to do that as well. Like, I think you're about to come on. I'd be like, don't you dare. But, like, today, I, like, burst out crying about something tiny. And then later on, and he was, like, really good about it. And I was really like, well, I just think it was a really thoughtless thing to say. And I got really upset. And then later on, I was like, so I think I'm about to come on my period. And he was just, like, quietly smiling. And he was like, okay. And I was like, and I know that you know that. And I know that you know that some of my behaviour earlier was by that, and I would like to thank you for not bringing that up. Like, it was me with like a little bit of distance on him. Oh yes, because I was about to rag, that's why.
But we're taught to sort of feel about a little bit of shame about, and I think there's a generation of female comics that have kind of taken that away to a certain degree, but we are made to feel shame about that process and that we might be hormonal, because men get hormonal as well. They get testosterone and they fight, you know. So we have this moment. I used to have a routine about describing periods to my boyfriend. Of one day we had a silly argument and he snapped at me, and I honestly can't remember what it was about, but I was very sensitive. And I was like, I'm on my period. And he was like, so? And I was like, well, I'm having my womb dragged out of me. Like, that's what's about to happen. I'm that inches away from that moment, and then describing building a house inside myself. that being the amazing part of what women can do with our own bodies. We can build houses inside ourselves for a baby. But actually, this is something quite magnificent and amazing that our bodies are able to do. And we're put through the ringer because of it.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that it should be a cheap or easy excuse, but to acknowledge that we do have mood changes and emotional swings.
Yeah, you would acknowledge if your partner had been working too much and they were knackered and they're a bit shitty with you. You'd be like, in your head, you'd be like, I get it, because they've been working loads. Like, you would understand that there's environmental, like, influences that affect our behaviour towards it. But so why they wouldn't be like, oh, my hormones are going absolutely mad very quickly, and I'm just going to be a bit oversensitive for a while. Or however it manifests, it's different with every person. But
I remember one of my early experiences doing the stand in Glasgow, and one of the other acts, who shall remain nameless, we were sat backstage, and I think it was Eva at the time who was working there, came in and said a thing, and as she left he went, God, she's so short today, is she on Blob or what? That is part of the environment that makes you go, well, I can't talk about this, I can't share about it, because we'll be diminished because of it.
Yeah, it's another weakness. I constantly talk about being on rag all the time, like with all my boyfriends, like as in friends who are boys and my boyfriend. And my boyfriend is like, you don't have to tell me every single thing that is happening to you. He's very relaxed about it. He's like, well, it doesn't have to be this in depth. I'm like, yes, it does. Because I'm convinced that I'm going to die when we've got like three daughters. And I'm like, you're just going to have to pick up that mantle and like to be so like,
menstrual man.
Yeah, you literally have. Yeah, you've got to understand what you're dealing with. You'll be able to talk them through everything. And he's like, I mean, that's fine, but I am eating. Like, can you just...
Paul's pretty good, actually. I have sent him out for tampons before, and he's gone, what magnitude? Which really made me laugh.
That's lovely.
Like, that men think of them like bullets. They're just going to be fired up there. So I think actually he's... And also because I have... And I can't remember if I've talked about this before, but you'll know anyway. But I get this like premenstrual, almost like dysphoria, PMDD, it's called dysphoric disorder, where I get like really about a week before. It's like suicidal bleak, like ideation, like crazy. So he's very much, my other half has had to very much be part of that journey with me, knowing that it's that is the thing that can save your life, that you go, this is a temporary feeling of low before I then come back into the world and realise that everything is not absolutely bleak. Mm. And it's a real genuine thing. And I think it happens as, you know, sort of tends to be women from sort of mid to late 30s get it. I don't think you have it so much. I didn't have it when I was younger, but it sort of came out of nowhere. And I was like, why do I feel so?
Gosh.
As someone who's been depressed before, I was like, this is terrifying. I don't know what this is. So understanding that, like taking the taboo away of talking about it and knowing that it comes with a set of unique hormones, problems and everything else is really, I think it's really therapeutic. And that's where I do feel like comedy, as part of the bigger conversation we're having here, can be a force of social change as well.
Totally.
Just making that, there's now girls who are unafraid to talk about that. And I think when I was growing up, and I think you're a bit younger than me, but I do, every advert was period blood is blue.
Yeah.
And you have to go rollerblading or jump out of a plane, you know.
In white trousers.
In white trousers. It's always a white dress or white trousers. Yeah. You're like,
I wouldn't wear them on a good day.
No one's wearing that. Like, who's wearing a, it's like going, oh, do you know what? I've got the shits today. So I was thinking white jeans would be a good idea. You know, like, you wouldn't do it. So I think I think everyone's sort of, if for example, just you saying that little small act, because, you know, tiny revolutions, a little small act. So even talk about it on stage or saying it to your partner or your male friends all the time of just going, I'm on the rag, which I love because it does sound like a West End musical.
I would watch that as well. I would watch that.
Going it's on my the
two,
rag.
Two like interests merged together is periods and musicals. Yes, please. I talked about in my second show, I talked about I had this routine about moon cups and I would go, I'm going to talk about periods now and we're going to be fine because it's 2000 and whatever year it was when I was doing it, 18, 17. And just like that was my way of without being that like either apologizing or being like, you have to be fine. It's look at what it is. And then did this like routine about moon cups. And that was me trying to be like, they're great, they're good for the environment, like, you know, just, but this is also a really funny routine about me buying the wrong size and all this kind of stuff.
That can go in the musical.
Yes, yeah,
fly absolutely. Me to the moon. But that's exactly it, like, it shouldn't be an issue. I sometimes, like, in this year's show, I really, like, kind of, last year's show for Bombshell, I really kind of went for the guys in the audience and did and told them that it was rock and roll comedy. When I was on my period, I'm like, this is a woman bleeding on stage. Did all of your icons, did George Carlin or Bill Hicks or Richard Pryor ever do that? No. It feels kind of like rock and roll. And I know men go, God, if it happened to us, we would relentlessly talk about it, you know. But exactly that. It's 2017, 2018. There was one year at the Fringe, I think, where like Carrie Ad and Rachel Paris had done this big video about...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was it Bad Blood, the Taylor Swift? Yeah. It felt like there was a wave, a big red wave of people kind of reclaiming it and talking about it. So, yeah. And also the tampon tax. There was a bit of a kickback against that. So do you feel like when you're on stage, you're doing a form of activism or are you first going, I need to make this funny? And if that comes, it's a bonus.
I always, for my shows, I'm like, what do I think needs talking about? And then I write something based on that. But I do the clubs. That's how I pay my mortgage. So it has to be funny above anything else. Don't get me wrong, not everything I write in my show will do, you know, the frog or the store on a weekend. And it's not meant to either. But it has to be able to hold its own as proper stand-up. And that's, I also think that, like, you don't always do your like most challenging highbrow, high concept stuff on a weekend, but there's always an element of that to what you're doing. And if you're in a rough club and you're surviving or smashing it, that in itself is a political act as a woman.
As a woman, it is, isn't it? Just being up there is a political act. I remember Catherine Ryan saying that as well. I think the club gigs are interesting. I was talking to Nish on a prior episode about having a really nice experience once at Up the Creek. And I don't go on and go, I'm a feminist. I just think if I have to say what it is, I've sort of failed a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like this idea of spoon feeding to people what they're getting. But having like older men come over and go, and it was a routine about consent and smashing back doors in, but like I've never really thought of it that way before. Like, that's so great. So is there ever a moment where you have an audience member in one of those club gigs where you've snuck something in under the radar or you're doing one of your bits that you go, I'm going to do this bit and this bit and this bit. And here's my juicy bit that I want to talk about.
Yeah,
it's in the middle
exactly.
of it, right?
Snuck that in.
Yeah. Have you ever had anyone come over and go, oh, I love that you did that or I love that you spoke about that?
It's really nice when like people you don't expect, because like loads of time it's women being like, I love the routine about like, you know, like whatever, like I don't show my legs either. Or like, I mean, I do show my legs, but it's about, I've got stuff about waxing and crabs dying out, which is a true thing. Keep it hairless because it's the destruction of their natural habitat, which is true. I had routines about that. And then you get people coming up and like, or someone will hack it's something that happens in the room and then you get, like older, like working class guy who like through definitely my own internalized prejudice that I'm like, this isn't for you. Being like, oh, I hadn't even thought about it like that. And you're like, yes, exactly. You just need to think about it like that. And in that case, you can be, that's why comedy is astounding. And like conversing generally, like comedy is so brilliant because generally, that's why I never want to really stop doing the circuit. Like, I know some people can't wait to get off it, but I think it keeps you match fit.
Oh, I agree. I work up all my Edinburgh shows doing club gigs.
Yeah, because it should be that good.
Smash it in those rooms.
Exactly.
Then I can take it out to my crowd and go, I've got this to a point where, you know, you're not just going to be nicely enjoying it because you like me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just hold its own. And it also, you never get that far out of touch with actual real people because we are in a bubble. And like, especially like, I live in Manchester.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
But like, I think more so bubbled down here of like, you know, like wealth and privilege, you know, relative privilege, obviously. And you can have an idea like, well, everyone agrees with me. And then stuff like Brexit happens. You're like, well, maybe not. but if you're playing the clubs, you never lose sight of that because you are meeting like, you know, probably about 600 people every weekend who are normal, who work really hard for their money. And they save up and they go out like, you know, once a month and they'll go to a comedy night. So you can't get that out of touch if you're talking to real people. Because they will also shout out if they don't agree with you and you suddenly find out that you're not in touch or, you know, and like you say, if you can make that Edinburgh stuff work in those rooms, then that's great. I always think when I'm writing stuff, I'm like, would my dad enjoy this? Because he's right. Just like, he's not university educated, he's like a mechanic, he's in his 70s, he's only ever really lived in rural Wales. I'm like, if he can enjoy the show and get it and laugh, then that's what I want because it's absolutely irritatingly pointless to me only making a show that postgrads, you know, from privileged backgrounds can enjoy.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, great. They already agree with you.
We can all
do
a smarmathon.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not saying that everyone who has a postgrad, but, you know, there is the of agreement.
Yeah.
They're bringing back, we were clicking gigs now. Like, I think in New York is coming back as a form of agreement, which means, yeah, we agree. And you're like, no, I want laughs. Yeah. I do want laughs.
Yeah.
I want laughs and I want to challenge. But that's, I kind of like that. I like a bit of being provocative and I like a bit of the pull and push in those rooms sometimes.
Definitely.
That you can get and winning them.
Because
there are some people who I go, it's not for you. And my entire career cannot be trying to convince men
yes.
that don't ever want to find women funny.
Yeah.
Funny. But there are a few people that you're like, if you like this type of comic who's a guy, you're going to like me.
Yeah.
So you've got to give it a go and I'll win you.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
are the ones I'm interested in sort of winning.
Definitely.
Like the older guys up the creek or someone at the Frog and Bucket or the store in Manchester.
Yeah.
Those are the people that you want. And sometimes, you know, I did a weekend at the Manchester store recently and I had a couple of bits that were like quite sort of, like rhetoric, they're routines with jokes in them, but they're quite rhetoric-y. And it's interesting when you're on bills with other people whose routines might be joke, or if you come out, it's like negotiating those things that are all the things that make you a better comic. If you come on after someone, I recorded a thing for Kevin Hart's Laugh Out Loud in Montreal. And the first act up was this guy from Atlanta who did a routine about the strip club. And one of the first lines was, you know, when you pull the bottle out of this bottle of a stripper's arse and it's covered in fecal matter. And you sort of go, so how do we follow this?
Yeah.
It's so relatable. Yeah, I can feel everyone in the room really thinking that's a relatable routine. So for you, it's a challenge you think you always want to be part of.
Definitely. I think it makes you just better because I want to be the kind of comic who can do Edinburgh and do the clubs. I've always like prided myself on coming up through the clubs and then
I did as well. And I think there's loads of comics who do both. It's quite a lot, you know, like Andrew Maxwell and people like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I think it's there were lots of people who were able to do both. I think there was one point in Edinburgh, it might have been Bruce Dessau or someone like that, but it was like, you know, it's sort of these people don't push themselves as hard, or since it was seen as like something cheap to try and go and earn money, you know, to go and get money. Whereas like actually these other people, they create these beautiful work of art shows and you're like, you know, it's possible to do both.
Yeah.
And I think that's classism, which is one thing I'd like to talk to you about actually as well, about comedy as a force for social change, because I feel like within comedy itself, there can be a real issue with class.
Yeah.
And how we define, or the prism through which we view what people do, and the allowances we give to people who we think are more educated from better backgrounds, yeah, as opposed to people who are working class. Do you think that's an issue?
Yeah, absolutely. Like in entertainment generally, it's something that needs to be addressed, because we talk about like quotas and diversity in terms of loads of things of, you know, like, and we should do. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have those conversations, but it's never in terms of class, which means that it's massively underrepresented. And all these things that people talk about, like I came up through the circuit as, because it's something I wanted to do, everyone I admired was on the circuit, and as a necessity, because if I wanted to make comedy pay, I needed to learn how to pay those big rooms, because those are the people who are going to pay me, because I don't take money from my parents and I never have. And like I had, you know, bills to pay, and then at one point I had a mortgage to pay. So, you know, it was just my way of like making it.
Yeah.
Like making it earn. And also that's like, there's one eye on that with like touring my shows as well, making sure they're accessible, because normal people need to come and see my shows and not feel like isolated. So I think it's really, I have such a complicated relationship with class, because I'm like, I'm a farmer's daughter. My parents scraped all their money together, and I was the youngest of three, and sent me to a private primary school. My secondary school was a normal school because I picked that one. I'd got like, I was going to go to a boarding school, but they couldn't afford it. I would have to day at this private school. And I was like, I don't want to go there. I wanted to go to a state school. So, but I have like worked through the like tax system since I was 14. I've worked on a farm since I was a child. I would have to get up in the morning, and I would have to, after work, I would have to start working. So like I work harder than most people I know. I have a good work ethic, and I have such a complicated relationship. When I see particularly, there's a thing at the moment, there's a bit of a groundswell in the like Northern Circuit as well, which feels overlooked, because a lot of it, Edinburgh is prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
And there were so many people from so many backgrounds going, I can't justify that. If they've got kids, absolutely not. I can't piss off and leave my husband or my wife to look after the children for 4 weeks, and I go then make $4,000 loss and have a good run still and do all that. So it just means that a certain type of person finds Edinburgh accessible, because
I didn't even know it existed till I was about 27, 28. I didn't even know it was a thing that existed.
Yeah. Like I remember when Gaines got nominated, and we were all like Salford Uni graduates, and just walking into those rooms, the people who clearly felt like they belonged there, and you don't. You're just like, what are we doing here? You feel like an idiot. And you're like, no, we're here because we worked really hard and we did a good show and we got nominated. But you're just like, I remember when Nika sat us all down, we're having our photos taken, and she was like, you know, like, well done. And then she was like, you know, as part of this, you'll get a run at the Soho Theatre. And we all went, fuck it, yeah. We like couldn't believe it. And everyone else was like quietly nodding because they just knew it and expected it. And it was like the whole time was feeling like we were just these like wide-eyed idiots that didn't know the system, and we were. And I just think that's a shame. It should feel like all this stuff should feel accessible, and it isn't. Like where I came from in Wales, like it's middle of bumblefuck nowhere. And I went to this drama club, and that's how I ended up doing what I was doing, because at 15 I was
I went to a drama
stuff.
Club. Yeah. Or like a kid's, not like, Sharon Harris it was called, but kind of they have Anna Sher in North London, which is where Ray Winston came through and people like that. And the West London one was Sharon Harris, and I would go to classes, and that's where I came through and managed to get, a commercial early doors and start working. But I couldn't even, I remember asking my parents if I could go to Sylvia Young, and like, you know, that just cost money. We just couldn't do it.
I used to pay for my own fees to go to, this is called, it doesn't exist anymore, which is one of the reasons why I am moving back to Wales to start one up, because there's nothing for those children who are talented. And like, or not even, you don't have to be talented. You could just want to meet other people who are like you, and you could just want something that's going to build your confidence. You know, not everyone has to end up on television, but like there is nothing there. And this, it was Anna Baker School of Drama, it was called, and we used to go there, and it was just like this whole world of like everything. And it was just like loads of like devising, loads of comedy, loads of musical theatre, but just being like, oh, this forever, and being like so into it, and it being so good for me.
Yeah.
And it's gone.
And an outlet for kids from I think with put off, if you're from a working class background, you're put off of being told it's not a sustainable career and there's no money in it and that you can't do, not for the likes of us type thing. And I have a complicated relationship with class in the same way that my mum's from a real working class background, got Welsh family, and then like Romany Gypsy on my grandfather's side. And my dad is from like quite rich Scottish Presbyterians.
Oh, wow. So,
but like when I was born for the first year, I was disowned by my grandmother because she said my mum couldn't speak the Queen's English. Like all of these kind of things. And then, so we lived, you know, we live in a terrace house and a pretty, you know, it's not, it's suburban, but it's not rough, but it's not great area of West London. And then, you know, like there were points where my mum and dad split up a few times when we were younger, and me and mum went in and out of like, you know, these sort of B&Bs, you know, like they have, you know, so I've kind of like seen all sides of it. But then my dad, when I was growing up, worked at Wembley Stadium. So I ended up having this kind of entry into not show business, but being around that, but not really being part of it as a performer from the other side of it, from, you know, and seeing all of that and being kind of excited by showbiz and everything else. But I had no idea how easy it can be if you are at the right school and you know the right people.
Yeah.
So there, I remember applying to drama schools, I think, after I left school, and I was like just doing temping jobs and stuff and promos and stuff like that. And not applying to drama schools, but applying to acting agents, and kind of like half of them just didn't even respond. This is when I was about 16 or 17. And that's how I ended up in Sharon Harris. She was the person who picked up the phone and went, well, I don't know who I'm turning down. So, and she'd get all these working class kids and bring them in, and they've gone on to do, like, you know, friends of mine who were there, like some of them were in Girls Aloud. I think Nicola was in Girls Aloud. And there's a girl called Stephanie Leonardis. She's in America doing all these big American sci-fi dramas and stuff. And they had all these kids, and they kind of got them off the street. And there was, not off the street, but it was like kids, you know, hormone surging, going through teenage years and trying to express emotions and actually doing comedy improv and that kind of thing, being a really good way to kind of channel that.
So good.
And knowing that that's an opportunity for a career. There was a thing that Des Bishop did. Des Bishop did a program in Ireland, and I always remember thinking, I think this should exist here as a scheme, where he went into what they call schemes in Scotland or estates, and he taught people stand-up comedy. And it's incredible. There's a comic. Have you ever met Willie White? Irish comic. He used to be a heroin addict. And if you're in Dublin with Willie, he'll show you around. He'll go, I used to shoot up there, him and his wife. They're now clean. He does stand up for a career. It's like you could write a film about his life, how comedy has changed his life and taking him from being an addict to going, you have a voice and something worth saying, and you can make people laugh and people care about you. They're interested in you. It's transformed him. And that was part of this series that Des did. So I went around like Ballymun and places like that and into the estates and found people and taught them stand-up comedy. Then they do stand-up comedy for the estate. I used to do street theatre, and that had like quite a lot of a vibe like that sort of in it. And I do think like it would be so amazing to have, imagine having a thing where they go into some of the really, you know, estates where there's poverty, and but more than poverty, there's poverty of aspiration, which I think is a real, real sad, desperate state of affairs, is the poverty of aspiration. If you are in a situation where you're like, I'm going to join a gang, I don't see any other way out, I'm never going to get the good things in life.
Yeah.
So it's not just about financial poverty, it's about
totally
where you think you can be. And to go in there and to teach those kids writing. You know, we had all the kitchen sink dramas in the 60s. Those seem to have disappeared, all those working class voices again. Yeah. So if we had a chance to kind of go in and go, hey, look, we'll teach you stand-up comedy, we'll teach you comedy writing and sketches.
Yeah, I did that. Like, I only just sort of stopped teaching that. I just don't have time at the moment. But I used to do... So I do stand-up workshops with homeless people. I say people, it's mainly men that are homeless. So I'd go and do workshops with them. And that was amazing, like the stories that you have in there. But like no one listens, because what do? Most people keep their eyes down and walk past someone homeless. So like hearing everyone's stories is incredible. And something about stand-up, it gives you such an agency to tell your story in your words. So also did it in loads of stuff in Mid Wales, which really suffers with rural poverty, which is like this invisible thing, which is something that like definitely where I grew up is a big problem. So Powys is this huge county in the middle of Wales, and there's fucking nothing there. But so we went and we worked with different groups. We worked worked with, because also Arts Council, I don't see comedy as a thing, but this guy had managed to get Arts Council funding for us and some funding from somewhere else that was to do with mental health. And I remember these theatre people being like, you won't get anything out of them, and being like, you know, this one, this person is nonverbal and this is this and this is this. I was like, okay, just leave it with me. I was like, the thing about comedy is like, what does everyone want to do? Especially when you're a teenager, you want to make everyone laugh. So like, you just create this amazing environment that's like, they get up and say anything, and if it's near funny, they get this like big roar of laughter, and you can just see them physically grow because like they suddenly stand up straight because they're like, what is this feeling? Because these are young people that people don't listen to, that people tell to be quiet all the time because quite often they're shits. So it's like pupil referral units, special educational needs, and like, because we work with a drama group as well who are all like, hi, blah, and they're great. I'm like, they don't really need us, except some of them are going to find stand-up and they didn't know that was the thing that they were good at. But like the ones I loved was when you have six 15-year-old boys who are constantly vaping and walking in and out of the class and like trying to ask you sexual questions like I'm going to get embarrassed, and you have them be like, I'm not doing it, and then one of them's like, yeah, I'll do it, and then smashes it, and then suddenly they all want to do it. I remember this one guy standing up, he's one of 11, this kid, and he started talking and sort of like told all these jokes and we're all laughing, and then he just said, he talked about how his mum had died when he was 9 years old, and since then he'd looked after his brothers and sisters. And I was like, oh my God, because he had just never said it out loud and had anyone listen to it before. And it was like, wow. It was amazing. It was amazing, and like such an act of bravery. Also, we worked with these young people, we looked after children who were children in care. That's incredible. Again, that's like such a complicated, like, you know, there's loads of love there, like for foster parents, but it's all sorts of attachment. A feeling of rejection. Of course, overwhelming, that is the feeling. So like incredible stories. And the one that really broke my heart was we worked with children who were carers for their parents. And like this amazing thing, because in that they're often quite, they're the kind of kids who are very good at talking to grown-ups, but not anyone their own age. And they kind of stick together, these young carers, because they get taken the piss out of, because quite often they're knackered, they're not very fashionable, you know, that everything's on a budget, all
they
that
don't
stuff.
Go and hang out with...
Exactly, all the stuff that you don't need when you're a teenager. So they're quite fun and boisterous, and they kind of know each other. And it's so nice because, like, they're just kids showing off and being really fun. And then the sad thing is that they walk out of there and you know that they've got to go and...
Be responsible.
Yeah, I've got to go and look after my two siblings, and I've got to go and wash, make sure mum's had a bath, do everyone's lunches for tomorrow. And like, it was that was hard, because I was like, the others, I'm like, I can give you a break and I can give you a sight of something. Like, well, because when they're talking to me, because I'm from somewhere like that. And the good thing, I don't know if it's the private school or it was my upbringing or having two older brothers, it's probably a combination of it, that I was always like, oh, the arrogance has really seen me through, because I'm like, I'm definitely good enough to be doing all this. So like, I never had that, like, I guess I won't make it. I'm like, oh, babes, I'll make it. Like, I was so, like, determined. Like, just how I meet, like, you know, those white average guys from private schools, I have that confidence. And that's really sort of, like, stood me in good stead. And I would just love to impart that on anyone else, because there's so many talented, brilliant people with stories to tell that don't get to say them. That's what I always think about. You know, we talk about like moving things forward for women in countries and developing nations, but like the best thing you can do is educate your women, because when you emancipate women, like, it's just the biggest boost for the economy. Like, don't talk about the internet, don't talk about this, talk about educating your women. It's the quickest way for a country to start making money. And I always think that about countries as well. I'm like, if we just educated like women everywhere, we'd have cured cancer. Someone somewhere would have had the, do you know what I mean? Like, there's so much stuff that could be helped, because like nearly half the brains in the world aren't being allowed to work to their full potential.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just think that like we can make such a difference with comedy. And like in 2 days, these boys who were like sat there in hoodies not paying attention were suddenly up on stage doing like 5 minutes of stand-up and smashing it. And you can just have these conversations that are difficult with comedy very easily and very quickly, because it is fun.
Yeah, you can shine a light in a dark corner and expose it and laugh at it, and kind of by bringing it into the room, sometimes it takes the gaslighting thing, like jokes about Bill Cosby, when that sort of happened, you felt there was a real, some people were a kickback, like, you can't talk about this. And you're like, no, because if you don't talk about this, what you do is you sweep it under the carpet.
Yeah.
And that makes it worse for everyone.
Yeah.
So bring it into the room.
Yeah.
Bring it into the room. We'll rip it apart.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole point about anything, jokes about Cosby, is you're like, I'm not going to make jokes at the expense of victims.
Yeah.
Anyone who's decent and good at comedy wouldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I reserve the right to make jokes about him.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and he's, what, 1 year or 2 years in jail that he's now been sentenced to.
Ridiculous.
Well, and his lawyer trying to argue because he's an old frail man that, you know, I mean, he can't be in an open prison. You just go, oh, that just means he's not going to pay. Yeah. You had to have an entire life of luxury and pay nothing, and other people have suffered. But that's why, you know, you go, now is the time, you know, that comedy can do that. That moment with Hannibal coming out and talking about that on stage is a real kind of...
It feels like the conversations being had in comedy at the moment are braver and more direct than anything in politics and anything in, like, the justice system. It's like, why are comedians sorting out the sexual attackers? Why are comedians calling out the sexism? Why are comedians, like, you know, like, yeah. Why is it us having to have the conversations? But it's a good thing, I guess, because we can, because I guess if whoever stands up, a politician, and, you know, like, you know, does a speech about misogyny, you're like, yeah, whatever. But when Hannah Gadsby does an incredible show about it, people watch and they listen and they learn from it. So I guess it's up to us to fix the world.
We can take it on.
Yeah, we've got a couple of afternoons. We can sort it out between us.
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah, put some shifts in.
We'll start WhatsApp.
That's really exciting, though, about the school then, that you're...
And I want to make sure
moving back to do that, are you?
Yeah, in the next couple of years when I feel like I can definitely not be constantly on call to London.
Right.
Although it's not too far from London, but like I'm a country girl at heart, and I really believe in putting something back, and I know how important that place was to me. So that seems like the obvious thing to do.
Yeah. It's really, I think that's really important that people listening to this go, can we not set up some of these centres or places in lots of different areas in the UK and where it feels, you know, life is hard. Let's have a little bit of creativity, even if people aren't going to go into a career doing that, to be able to express yourself creatively is really important.
Why does everything have to be a career as well? Like, you know, you could just be great at it and it can be your outlay, and like the transferable skills. Like, I have never not got a job because I can talk my way into every single job.
Oh, we're top blaggers.
Yeah.
Comedians are like the ultimate blaggers.
Yeah, exactly. So all that you learn from, you know, like being up on stage and puffing out your chest and, you know, like all that stuff is just so good. It's so brilliant for young people. It's brilliant for everyone, to be honest. And that's what I saw. Like, I remember doing a thing with the homeless people where they had this, it was a conference, and it was all the different organisations around the Northwest who work with homeless people, and they were bringing them together. And they were like, whilst we're talking about this thing, can you take everyone, at, like all these homeless people, and can you do a workshop with them? And I'm like, yeah, but there was hundreds. I was like, I can do my best. So we just sort of did a bit of a thing and like had people up doing stuff. And I remember this one guy going up, and he was the youngest person there. He was only like 17, he was homeless. And he was like the whole time he was like jiggling in his seat, and you could tell he just so wanted to go up. I was like, mate, do you want to go up? He's like, I'm like, you haven't sat still. And he's like, no, I'll be all right. And then he would be like, you know, like trying to guess the end of people's jokes. He was so into it. And I was like, I think you're going to be great. Just come up and do it. And so he got up to the microphone. He got like his first four words out, and then he totally broke. And he's like, I can't do it. He started swearing, started to walk away. And I remember this woman who obviously knew him was also homeless. She ran up beside him and she dragged him to the microphone. And she put his hand around his waist, and she was like, we can do this. Aww. And he did it, and it was like everyone was really laughing, but like I was like, oh my god, in tears.
Yeah.
Again, because I was about to come on. I was like, I cannot deal with this. But it was like the most special, beautiful moment that young, brilliant, talented guy got to have in front of a room full of people. He got to make them laugh and be brilliant, because he is brilliant, just circumstances haven't allowed him to be. And just a taste of that is like, you might think, oh,
life changing.
Yeah, it's life-changing, because he might just go, I can't believe I got up and did that. What else can I do? It's so important to give people a chance.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks
I think
for
it's been magnificent. Yeah, go check out All Killer, No Filler.
Yeah, thank you, mate.
This is Kiri's podcast. Thanks for coming.
Also from Lush Podcast, the John Robb tapes. Punk legend John Robb digs through his cassette tapes to bring you exclusive interviews with other musical icons. Some are from the vault and some are brand spanking new. Find the John Robb tapes wherever you find podcasts and on the Lush Player.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.